Welcome along, everyone. It is the first in the second series of The Wrong End of the Tunnel, and today me and Dave are going to be answering questions that we had on our Facebook group. But first, how was Christmas, Dave? Did you enjoy?
Oh, yeah. Always enjoy a bit of Christmas. Love
time
getting
with
presents.
Friends and family, innit?
Eating. Well, it's always friends. It was friends this year. But yeah, lots of food, as always. Back on the diet now. And games and training the dogs. Yeah, I had a really nice Christmas, actually.
We've been a while since we've done an episode of this together. What kind of stuff have you been doing? I'm guessing you've been doing kind of GB prep stuff. We've done a little bit together as well, haven't we?
Yeah, lots of GB prep with Susan. Last year, I felt like I obviously didn't feel like I prepped well enough. So I've done a lot more this year with her, like skills-wise, training-wise. And training the puppy, training 40 quite a lot. She'll be competing in April, so not long. So lots to train her. I don't actually know how it all gets fit in the 18 months. I don't know how I'm going to teach her A-frame, seesaw, get her jumps up, finish her weaves, and do a dog walk in new places, and teach her to sequence all in the next... sequence enough to get around courses in the next 3 months. It's crazy.
I'm the same with Hippie as well. I think someone said to me, oh, Hippie will be coming out this next season, won't she? And I was just thinking, probably not. I maybe jumping. Like, jumping is potential, but I just think there's so much stuff now that they need to kind of have as skills before get going, isn't it? It's quite hard to get it already in 18 months.
You don't want to do too much too young, so you feel like you've got to shove it all in the last few months, and it's just... I don't know. Well, we'll see. She's an amazing little puppy, but there's a lot to do. So maybe hopefully jumping. She'll get weaves done. Hopefully jumping courses. We'll see what the courses are like and maybe some bits of agility courses, but I don't think she'll be doing the whole thing.
Like you say, the good thing as well is you've got other dogs to be able to compete with, so there's no real rush, is there?
Yeah. Nah, she's all right.
With regards to this season, what are your aims this year? I know we briefly talked about it in your other podcast, but I thought seeing as this is kind of... you know, the start of the new season, where are we looking with Susan, especially?
Susie, I would love to qualify for the two big events this year, CEOs and Worlds. Really would love to. I think she's a cool dog. Whether she's quick enough for individual, I don't know. I'd like to think she could be.
I think she's similar speed to...
Yeah, she's good. I think she's a similar speed to Lemon, and she just got a silver medal, but it does very much depend on the courses and how everyone else does. I don't think she's the fastest dog in the world, but she's got cool skills and she's tidy and she's a nice little dog. Definitely a good team dog, I think, if we can get her act together this year. But she's still so young, like she's just four, like she's not an old dog. So that's my aim with her. And obviously I'd like to win some tickets, get to Crufts. Not so bothered, Crufts singles and Olympia. I'd like to, but it's not my biggest aim this year, because I think Olympia is also going to clash with Gold Rush, I think. So I think I'd rather go to Gold Rush at the end of this year. That's my plan anyway. We're not going to try and try it out, but we'll see, because you never know what happens with going abroad. So, well, we'll just go for everything. But my main aim's EOs and Worlds.
Okay, so that's where you're going to put the thing on. What about any breeding plans this year, or kind of undecided on that?
Not really. No plans. I don't need another puppy for ages. Got enough bloody dogs. I'm a dog hoarder. So... enough dogs. I'm fed up with old dogs. They're so stressful. So let's just, no breeding plans for me this year. Whether we breed from Tapas or not, we've got a little bitch we could breed from. I don't know. She's quite young still, so we'll probably wait another year.
Okay, cool. All right, well, little catch up there, done and dusted. Let's get on to the questions then, okay? So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read them out as they are. And maybe we'll have to kind of think of a way of rewording them, because I think not all of them are kind of questions. Some of them are kind of more topics, and I don't want any one question to take up the whole episode. So we might have to kind of change them a little bit. Okay, first question then from Karen. Love to hear more about working with and competing with hard dogs. And she says dogs that lack confidence, the one pole dogs, dogs that push you. How you navigate, I couldn't talk then, how you navigate the highs and lows, that sort of thing. Is there always an answer? So let's go first with the sensitive dogs. What would you say is the best way to approach that?
I think with sensitive dogs, it's very much not rushing them, not doing too hard, too young, keeping it easy, keeping it fun, not allowing too much failure is a huge thing for those dogs. I think people just get so excited to do the hard stuff and move on to the fancy, sexy stuff, and they just don't go back to doing just nice, easy, flowy, open, fast, fun courses. And I think those sensitive ones need so much of that for the confidence in agility and actually running, teaching them to really run. So don't move on too fast. And the whole, maybe they're sensitive about the environment. So lots of taking them to new places and like always don't think, oh, they're not puppies anymore. I don't need to work on their environment skills. Take them to new places all the time. You know, go to the supermarket with them, go to the pet shop with them, and just don't try and force them to interact with their environment. Just try and teach them to interact with you all the time. So you are the most important thing in their lives. And if they're scared, they should want to take that confidence from you rather than want to just bolt from the situation. So it's all about, again, relationship. I talk about it so much, don't I? It's all about building that relationship with you and making you that person that's going to protect them. And then when you are at the competitions, be very aware of the environment. People just switch off to their dogs and allow bad things to happen to them. Because I'm constantly with Susan, aware of everything that's going on around her. And if something does happen, like a dog snaps or something, I'm furious at myself because I've allowed that situation to happen, which would put her back a few steps. So managing the situation so you don't allow them to become scared.
Yeah, that's a good answer. One from my point of view as well, obviously something that I've actually dealt with personally as well. Cop, he's perfect dog. He's a perfectionist though, and that sometimes affects his confidence. Makes him a little bit sensitive to when it goes wrong. And one thing that I used to do, thinking that I was helping, was I would basically muddy the waters with regards on clarity of what I wanted and what I didn't, because I was trying to protect him. In the sense of, like, if he didn't do something right, I'd be like, oh, it's okay, buddy, no problem, and kind of still reward. So actually making his reward structure far more clear wasn't... I was thinking of it as being unkind because I was being really strict, but it's actually more unkind to not have that clarity. And as soon as I had that understanding of him, that all he wanted to do was get it right... and then my reward structure became far more clear, and that if I was very happy with something, I jackpotted it. If something was just a good effort, he had a good reward. And if it was completely wrong, it was just withhold the reward, but we never dwelled on it. We rushed back to the start and did it again so that he could get a reward straight away. So rather than rewarding the stuff just for the sake of effort, which I thought was being kind to him, that was actually not kind because it made it less clear of what we wanted. So having a really solid reward structure helped my situation.
That is important.
Yeah.
People have to be a bit careful with that though, because it's good if you're a good handler and you know you've got stuff right. But I think a lot of people don't reward their dogs when they fucked up themselves. It's handler error. Yeah, that's what's where people go wrong, I think, with their reward, is that they've literally done something completely wrong with the handling, and the dog's obviously done it wrong, and they then punished the dog by not rewarding it, and then the dog really starts shutting down and getting confused. So that's why it's good to train with other people that can see that. So then obviously I often reward the dog because I think, well, it's hands, you know, fuck up. So, and I'd say with me, when I know I fucked up, straight away dog gets toy. If it's something easy and I've said tunnel and they've bugged off to a jump, then obviously I don't just reward everything, but you have to be very careful and very clever with your reward structure. And like you say, the clearer, the better. But if it's your fuck up, you've still got to reward the dog. It doesn't have to be a jackpot, but just something to say, sorry, mate, I buggered up. Here's a reward, but we'll repeat and we'll try and get it right.
Yeah, that's a good point to make. I think with mine, I was more specifically talking when you're teaching a new skill without handling, if that makes sense.
Yes. Oh yeah, definitely. We're teaching a new skill, yeah.
Yeah, no, but that's a good point to make as well. When you're running and you're running a course, and even if you think, oh no, that wasn't my fault, but if it hasn't gone right, it's your fault because either you haven't trained it right or you haven't handled it right anyway. Exactly. So I'm not talking so much about the course running aspect. I'm more talking about teaching a skill, but it's definitely a good point to bring up. What would you do then, Dave, if you're training a dog that is very poly? So constantly taking rails
again,
is how Karen.
So, so dog dependent, because this is where I think I made a mistake early on with Commotion. Because I was like, right, because with Fame, I used to reward her throwing poles down. And I was like, because I was happy, she was jumping pretty. Courses were ugly. She was, I mean, if you've been on the Love the Lines workshop, anyone, you'll see I've got videos of her doing courses, and she was young, and they were just so awful. She couldn't not have had the poles down. So I think if I hadn't been quite lax with her reward, and like, I would have been quite, I was quite, you know, I didn't correct hardly any, I think she would have learned to go slower. But with Commotion, I thought, right, I'm going to be super strict now. I'm going to correct every pole. But then I think he used to collect, have a pole. I would mark the pole, not even bad. I'd pick up, he'd run in, he'd grab the pole. You know, it was a, I showed him what he did wrong, but it wasn't a punishment. He was never worried by it. But I do then think, oh, I won't collect then, because now I'll just launch at the jumps to make sure I keep the pole up. So I think you've got to be, some dogs can deal with correcting every pole. Like Nara did that with Lemon, and she can deal with it so well. Other dogs just can't deal with that level of correction. Like Susan, I didn't correct any poles when she was young. I
I
just
couldn't
carried
deal
on.
with that.
Her correct, she corrected herself. But these days, now she's tougher, I've toughened her up in agility. These days, I do correct her poles. She looks a little bit upset, and it's not hard correction. It's literally, ah, like, oh, what have you done? Pick up pole, but she looks like, oh, you know, she's such a puddle. It's a wet little puddle. She has a panic attack about it, but she can then work through that and come back and be just as good as, go just as fast as she did to us before. She would have shut down and gone slower. So it's really knowing your dogs, and also knowing why they've had the pole. Like if they've had a pole that they have all the time, then yes, it needs correction. If it's just an odd pole, like a one-off, then I'd probably just let it go, because it very much is dog dependent. If you've got a dog that's having tons of poles, yes, they need to be corrected. If you've got a dog that's having the odd pole now and again, no, I'd probably let it go, especially if they're a bit sensitive. So it is known, all about knowing your dogs.
And again, if you have got a dog, again, this is just something that I've noticed from an experience of my own. If you have got a dog that you can correct, firstly, like I said, like Dave said, you need to make sure that they can take it. I wouldn't have been able to do that with Cobb because he's already careful. If he takes a pole, it's generally not his fault. But the one thing that I would say is if you are going to correct poles, you need to do it all the time. You can't pick and choose when. Because like you'll see some people who do it sometimes, they correct a pole and then they come to a competition and they don't. And it's like it's very hard for the dog to understand if there's no consistency in that.
I think it's some, like, I know why my dogs generally have had poles. I know if it's my fault, I know if it's their fault, I know if it's the surface fault, I know if it's just that particular angle. So I think it is all about knowing that, because I do, you know, I'll correct some with Susan now, but if she has the odd one down, that's like a something I know was really hard for her, but she did a really good skill, I wouldn't jackpot, but I'd go, okay, well done, and carry on. But then I'll come back and she has it down again, I might correct it. So it is just about really knowing your dogs. But if you can't see that, then yes, you need to be very black and white. But if you can see those things, then you could probably be a bit more clever with it.
And then the lot, like, there's so many different types of dogs and different types of problems. So I don't want to go through all of them, but I think this last one is quite a good one because it's quite common. How would you approach a dog that's like really pushy, but also one that herds and doesn't care, if that makes sense?
Oh, the herdiness needs to be fixed at home way before you take it into the ring. Like if your dogs are herding you all the time at home, then that needs to be stopped. Because I see people, they have these herdy dogs in agility, and I see them walking in the field and the dog's just circling, circling, circling. I think, well, no wonder they're bloody doing it when you go to the bloody ring. Like you got to be clever. Like I hate my dog. My dogs are collies. Of course they herd, but they don't herd me. They generally herd each other, which I don't mind so much. But I hate them when they, you know, you try and do a circle with them and they just want to shoot off 10 million miles. And it is about teaching them at home and not allowing that behavior to happen so much at home, and then taking it around equipment. But I think people allow things like that so much. It's like when dogs miss a running dog walk, they'll herd all the way back around to start the contact. I can't bloody stand it. Like it's again, some dogs you can get away with that, and other dogs that herd anyway, you're gonna, it's just, you're allowing that and always teaching it that it's okay when they go wrong to do that massive loop de loop, and then it just creates bad behaviors elsewhere. So it's about managing it and teaching it right from the beginning, building value for being close to you, and not allowing that continual herd all the time.
And then this is a question from me then, because it just made me think. What do you think about taking, if you've got a dog that you've got, you know, it's a pet first, obviously, but your number one sport is agility. How do you feel about people trying the herding then as well? Do you think it's a good idea?
Again, some dogs you can get away with it, some dogs you won't. So I've seen some dogs that are amazing at herding and amazing at agility. Some dogs are just born to do whatever you ask them to do. Other dogs I know that are herdy, that do herding and then comes to agility, have a lot of the herding behaviors in the agility. So maybe it's just a training, something wrong going wrong with the training. So maybe some people just training them better that they can do both sports. And maybe it's the dogs. Some dogs understand when they're sheeps and there's a big field, they can herd. And other dogs understand when it's agility, they need to be a bit tighter. So I personally would be nervous to do both, but I'm not saying it's wrong because I've seen some dogs that can do both brilliantly. I've seen some dogs that cannot do both.
Yeah, fair point, I think. Okay, next question then. Do you think agility ever could or should be an Olympic sport? So first, do you think it could be?
Oh, I don't know. I would love it to be. It would be so cool, but I don't know. I just don't know enough about it. Like they always say that it's not about it's because handlers are not given awards. It's only the dogs and the handlers can't get awards. So that's something we're doing in Nexus. We're looking into is to actually award the handlers as well. Because someone like it sounds so arrogant now, but someone like me who's had lots of agility champions, I think six, and I've now worked it out. I don't have anything that says I'm like. I've done well myself. My dogs have all done well, but unless I go on about it on these podcasts, no one has a clue how many I've got. So I can always pick myself up. So,
You'll have to get you a
yeah,
badge for
I
next
think
season.
so.
I'll get you a
Nexus.
nice badge for you.
Thanks. I want a really big one. Come on my old chest. So, yeah, I think that in Nexus, we're going to start giving awards to handlers that have done well over the years as well, and they've actually had multiple champions, etc., etc. So we're looking into that. So possibly in the future, if that becomes normal, yes, but right now I don't think it can. What's that you got?
It's a little back scratcher. Like, look.
Got a back scratcher. I
Look at that.
want one.
Oh, I'll get you one
It's
for
so
Christmas.
cute.
Get you one for next
No,
Christmas.
thanks.
So why do you think then that what is making you hesitating to say that it should be an Olympic sport? Because like I get that you're saying that it's not the handler that's being awarded, but is that a reason to make it not an Olympic sport? And again, I'm not
I think
disagreeing with you.
that's the
I'm playing
reason
devil's
that they
advocate.
give.
You are?
Yeah. I think that's the reason they give
Oh, okay.
for not being like the powers that be, whoever they are. But it's not my reason.
No.
It's that's their reason. I think it should be as it is. I think, you know, in the day, yes, they ride the horses, but the horse still has some say in what happens. I know we're not attached to the dogs, but it's still a sport, isn't it? Like, I would love it to be. The only problem with it becoming an Olympic sport is there'll be a lot more money involved. Like a huge amounts of money. You know, when something becomes an Olympic sport, you get huge sponsors and you get this and the other. And will that be detrimental to the training side? Because then people, if it's more money's involved, dogs and animals generally become more of a commodity. And they're not so much pets, they're more sport animals. And I do worry that it would be, in some ways, it would make them so training could become strict. Because when there's more money involved, people just go a bit crazy, don't they? And it could training could become stricter, people get tougher on their dogs, it could go a bit more backward in the whole training side of it because you know positive punishment is obviously something we don't do, but annoyingly with some dogs it will work. Like if a dog you know does something wrong, if it's a tough enough dog, you know, it can be have a smack for doing something it shouldn't do in agility, having a poll. And yes, it will work that dog, it might work for that dog. And if people train like that a bit more, because I know some countries I'm not going to mention any, but some countries are tougher in their training than the UK are, definitely. And it does work for the dogs, which is annoying because I'd love it all to be positive, 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 but it's not always the way. Positive punishment can work. And I don't like that it does. And I think if it became an Olympic sport and more money was involved, I think maybe more people would be a bit more onto that side of the training because it's more stressful because of the money.
Fair point. Okay, we're going to move on to the next one then. Millie asks, with regards to your mental game, how do you prepare yourself for big events? And I know you've kind of covered this, but do you want to give a brief overview on it?
Yeah, I just I'm lucky I don't have to go do too much for myself. I know other people do a lot of prep, but I think prep is important. Like if you have prepped well and you know you've prepped well, then like I've done courses from the judges, you've done the skills from the judges, you know you've got a good relationship with your dog, you know that they can do the courses. If you go to the court into the tryouts or whatever you're prepping for, and you see the course, you think, I can't do that, then you know you haven't prepped well enough. I want to be able to look at the course and go, I can do that. I know they can do that. Obviously, it might go wrong, but I know they can do it. I know they've got the skill to do it. I think last year, I didn't go into every course thinking that, and obviously, I hadn't prepped well enough. This year, I'm really hoping that I look at the courses and I go, well, I know they can do that because I've trained something, either that or something similar before. So I know they can do it. I've just got to handle it correctly. And obviously, it's got to go right on the day. So I think prep is probably the most important thing to get your headspace right, because if you're unprepared, then you're going to be more stressed.
Yeah, for sure. And from my point of view, again, with regards to your mental preparation and stuff, I think it's more about, a lot of people get it wrong in that they try to focus on the outcome of something. So let's go to the GB tryouts as an example. They are focusing on getting on the team. And because the focus is totally on that, it makes them nervous about what they're actually doing. But yeah, it doesn't matter about what you're doing. It doesn't matter about the outcome. You need to focus on what you're doing, because that's the only way that you can affect the outcome. So I would always say to people, can you control what it is you are concerned about? If you're nervous, for example, and if you can't control that, then you should be focusing on something that you can. And for most people, most of the time, that will be the process. So you focus on what it is you're actually doing, and focus on what you can do in it. So like Dave said, if you're in on a course, and maybe you haven't prepped well enough, there's no point in focusing on the bits that you can't do. You need to focus on how you could potentially do it, and then just do everything that you can to be able to do it, rather than worrying about what you can't do, because that's not going to help.
Stop thinking. Don't go in there, like you say, don't go in there and think, oh, if I can't do this course, I'm not going to qualify. Everything's over. Just take each course as it comes, or, you know, just also you do have to enjoy it, especially if you've got to the final. It's just not just about, you know, about the world tryouts and stuff. If you've got to the final, Olympia crafts, you know, just enjoy being in that environment, that situation. And if you're enjoying it, you're going to be less stressed. If you're constantly worried about how you're going to do, how you're going to look, are you going to win, are you going to come last, then it's less enjoyable. Just go out, enjoy your dogs, enjoy running those courses, and enjoy being in that, getting, at least you've got to that final. A lot of people haven't. So try and enjoy the situations, because you only live once, and, you know, the dogs aren't around anywhere near long enough. So enjoy everything you do with them.
Yeah, I was just looking further down the questions, and there's another one that's related to this, so I thought I'd do it now. What do you do if things don't go according to plan? And I think that is a question regarding mid-course. So if something doesn't go to plan mid-course, how do you cope with that, or how do you adjust?
Obviously, it depends on the course, but I'm personally not, I haven't been in the past great at correcting something when it's gone wrong. I usually let it go wrong, think, ah, no, oh well, it's gone wrong now. But I just try and just carry on, just get on with it. I'm not one of those people that has a bit of a strop in the middle of the course and runs out. I always want to finish it. I want to finish the course and enjoy running that course that I started. Unless it's a course that I absolutely hate it, then I might leave. But that doesn't happen very often. I think just go, you know, at the end of the day, it goes wrong. That is agility for you. It is going to go wrong sometimes. Just pick yourself up, finish course, go outside, have a think about it, have a cry about it, and then pull yourself back together for the next one.
Yeah, just put things in perspective. It's not, you know, it's not the end of the world if it goes wrong. Obviously, we all want to do well, but if it doesn't go well, nothing changes really, does it?
Not as many people do well as the people that want to do well. So, you know, there's going to be very few people winning.
Yeah,
you're going to have to remember that. There's a lot of people. Exactly. There's a lot of, well, different in each height, but there's always going to be a lot more people unhappy than happy at these events. And you've got to remember that. If everyone is going through the same thing, it's not the end of the world. You, at the end of the day, you do have to have however much prep you've done stuff. It's always a bit of luck on the day if it all goes correct.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to put it in perspective, exactly.
So the next question then, Lee says he's over 50 and his first agility dog, and the dog is super talented. How does he make sure he doesn't let him down?
Oh, well, that's a hard one, but like, does the dog care if he's being let down? Like, who cares? Like, the dog doesn't care. The dog's having a good time. Like, I think we've all had dogs that we thought, well, I probably could have done a bit better with that one, or like, I could have won that, just got a bit unlucky. I think just take each day as it comes and just do as much, you know, get the right help, go to the right people for training. and just do as well as you can. Not everyone is going to be a world champion. So even there's plenty of dogs that could be world champions, but, you know, are those dogs let down because they've not become world champions? Or is people just enjoying their dogs and doing the best they can with them? You know, we always feel like I've got had dogs in the past that I thought, oh, didn't do as well. That one should have won that, or that one should have won that. But at the end of the day, when it comes to it, and they're really old, and, you know, it's maybe the end of their lives, you don't remember the agility. All you remember is the fun things you did together and all the memories you had. The agility and the results mean absolutely nothing when it comes to that. So I think there is no letting them down. Yeah. And as long as the only way you let them down is by not rewarding enough, or them not being happy. So that's my point. That's my view.
And I would say that if you're at a point where you know that the dog is super talented, then training is obviously going quite well at the moment anyway, because otherwise you wouldn't be saying that they're super talented. So yeah, just keep going.
Exactly. Yeah, just enjoy it.
And now a quick word from our amazing sponsors, Better Dog.
Hi guys, Dalton and Jody here from Better Dog.
We have just launched our new product, Better Hydration, the goat's milk hydration drink for dogs.
It's packed full of natural ingredients designed to give them that extra boost whether they are working, competing, or just simply enjoy an active lifestyle.
Head over to wearebetterdog.com to find out what it's all about and use your exclusive discount code WRONGENDOFTUNNEL for 10% off.
Because every dog deserves better.
I think this next one is a message to you to see basically if you're single. Tori asked, in the last podcast that she listened to, that night she dreamt that you and her were best friends. I think that's code. So if you are looking to go the other way for Christmas, Dave, Tori is open to a message.
How good of friends were we, is what I want to know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is that like...
If I'm ever fancying the turn back, I'll give Tori a call.
Yeah, new year, new you.
Exactly. I've had enough of Dan anyway.
Yeah, fair play. Okay, so Charlotte asks, periodization and cross training, peaking your dog for important events, and maybe the handler too. So I'll answer the handler bit. So what would you do for the dog?
If to prepare for a big event.
Yeah, I think she's talking about cross training. I think what she means there is more like fitness. And with regards to your training, do you change it in the lead up to events?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely increase my training in the lead up to big events. I there's peaks and troughs in their fitness over the year. You cannot keep them at that level for international events the whole year. It will burn them out. So that's why I don't do every single world championships out there. Like, I would love to do WAO as well, but I cannot. I would rather do EOs and world champs because to me, they're more fun. I'm not so into the games classes and stuff. I would love to do all three though, but I cannot peak three times in a year. I think it's just the fitness I get them to, the level I want to get them to for those events is just too high, and they wouldn't have enough downtime in between if I did all three. So yes, on the build up to big events, I will increase fitness. I will try and do more cardio with them. I will try and do more strength training with them. So that includes like, you know, wobble cushion stuff, you know, fit pause stuff, like all their fitness things. And they'll get slightly longer walks. They'll get a bit of sprint training. They will get hopefully some swimming and obviously up their agility training a little bit as well. Maybe I'll probably do an extra skill session a week at least. Maybe an extra course riding session a week. Obviously, it depends. You know, this isn't for months before. This is for like a month, maybe 6 weeks before I'll start building up their fitness. So hopefully, so I don't want to peak too early. Just finding that little peak you want to go to that competition before, feeling really good about yourself and your dogs and knowing that you're both in the best condition you can be. I'm never in the best condition I can be. That's another story. But I definitely try and get my dogs in the best condition they can be.
Well, from a human point of view, with regards to periodization of training, yeah, it's definitely a thing. Essentially, you do have to prioritize your calendar year and your schedule in general as to what events are you looking to be at your peak performance for. Like Dave said, you can't... So if you've got a calendar year, let's just look at it over 1 year rather than look on a bigger scale. If you are wanting to peak in May, then you can't, for example, be doing power and speed stuff all the way from the previous July up until May. It'd be too much. And you need to build other areas to make it so that you can potentially build your power and speed more anyway. It's that glass ceiling effect where if, for example, you're looking to build power, then yeah, you can get to a certain level of building power without looking at anything else. But if you also look to improve strength, elasticity, mobility, then when you get to power, you've got a higher potential. So you could become more powerful than you could have if you hadn't addressed the other stuff previously. So for myself, with the people who I train, we go through different periodization blocks. And the first one is always hypertrophy or muscle building. And then we look to let the muscles recover, give them a chance to kind of take a break from all the speed and power type stuff. Then we go into like a strength block, and then we go into more sports specific stuff. So yeah, periodization is definitely a thing. You have to make sure you have equal amounts of chance for your body to recover as well. I think that's equally as important, as Dave said. Beth then asks, she would be interested in a podcast about agility injuries. So we're not going to do a full podcast on it. But basically the question she asked is, how would you kind of structure getting a dog back to work?
Obviously, it depends on the severity of the injury. Let's just go for a common one, so just like a muscle strain. So muscles are going to take, if untreated completely, muscles are going to take 4 to 6 weeks to heal. If you have, you know, actually broken muscle fibers, they're going to take a long time to heal. You know when you've hurt a muscle yourself, it does take a while. And if you're still exercising and doing things in that 4 to 6 weeks, that's going to re-injure it if you're not careful. So instantly my dogs will have time off. They'll have, until they're sound, I will generally do house rest, maybe some lead walking, depending on the dog. So you don't want it completely still. You do want to keep it moving a little bit, but very gentle lead walking. Then slowly just build up. If they don't go sound, then obviously you know something worse going on, and then you need to go to bed, get things scanned, etc. But if they go sound quite quick, maybe after 2 or 3 days, you know, if they are lame after rest, so if they're rested and get up and they're lame, it's most likely a muscle injury because it's swollen, and while they've been resting and then they walk it off, the swelling goes. That generally indicates muscle injury. So I want that to go away before I'll even consider any form of more exercise. So then I'll start lead walking more, build up the lead walking till they know they're completely sound on a good lead walk. Then I might start letting them off for like 5 minutes at the end of the walk, then 10 minutes and just build up slowly. When I know they can go off lead for walk and still stay sound, I will start doing tiny bits of agility. I will test them. So I do like 5-6 jumps. If they stay sound, excellent. Next time I train them might be a little bit more. So everything's built up very slowly. If they go lame again at any point, it's back to square one, rest. So, you know, people come to me and go, oh, they're a bit lame yesterday, but they seem okay today, so I'm going to train it. And I think, it's not really my job to tell you not to. And I do say, like, I wouldn't. Yeah. But, you know, people do not allow injuries to recover anywhere near long enough most of the time. They give a week off, oh, they're sound now, it's fine, they can go. But muscle injuries do not heal like that. What it'll do, especially untreated, muscles are nice along lines. If they get injured and break, when they reform, they reform in more of a mesh. So then you get the scar tissue and the muscle's a bit shorter. So then when it's stretched again, it's easier to break because it hasn't been worked through and stretched back out. So it's super important to get some treatment on there too. Someone to break down the scar tissue when it started healing, stretch it out so that the muscle heals in nice long lines again, rather than any kind of mesh or scar tissue, because that will re-injure a lot easier. So if people are getting these repetitive injuries, you're probably not getting it treated well enough or at all, because it needs to be stretched out, or they're not having long enough rest after injury. So me and Dan personally are really funny about how quick people bring their dogs back from injuries, having puppies, all sorts of rest just after they've had a few weeks off. We're very funny. We take a long time to bring our dogs back from things like that.
And like, I think it's important as well to mention that Dave is qualified in these things as well, so he can talk on actual rehab practices. Myself, it would be lying with outside my remit to talk about injury rehabilitation. But what I can say is the amount of humans who continue to work or continue to race when they are injured absolutely does my head in, because they wouldn't do it with their dogs, but they you see them running and they've got like They're on the biggest limp in the world, and they continuously do it. And then their injury never gets better. They end up managing an injury for a whole year instead of taking what could have been 2 weeks off. Yeah. You know, obviously, exactly. By the end of it, it might end up being a lot more. But if they'd have taken the 2 weeks off in the start, they might have had the rest of the year absolutely fine. But in the end, they couldn't miss a weekend of competition, and they end up managing an injury for a whole season. And that frustrates me.
It frustrates me. Like, rest is the most important thing. It's one of the reasons I didn't really enjoy being an osteopath, because people would bring their dogs to me. They didn't like what I told them, how long they need to rest. They'd go down the bloody physio down the road. Nothing against physios, but they go down to somebody else down the road. You know, someone else, maybe slightly less qualified, because, you know, it is quite hard to become an osteopath. And then they would tell them, they'll be fine in a few days. And obviously, that's the first thing they want to listen to, because that's what they wanted to hear. And that would drive me up. Or then they come back in 6 months, they're lame again. Well, no bloody wonder they're lame again, because you didn't rest them enough. People don't want to hear some of the things I've got to say. And it drove me crazy. Same with treating for humans. Again, people stop resting as soon as they feel a bit better, even though it's not fully healed. And then they come back in a few weeks and go, I've hurt myself again. Well, no wonder you bloody hate yourself again, because you didn't bloody listen.
Yeah, but so, some people still compete even when they are injured. They got like half a leg and they're still trying to compete.
The amount of people that compete, their dog's still injured. And you go, you see these big vets, they're limping out the ring. So you think, you fucking asshole. And they know it. And they're like, you can see them trying to hide it. Like, they'll try and run with them, so the dogs are cantering rather than trotting, so you can't see the lameness. Or they'll pick them straight up after the run. There's a very well-known handler who was very much in the limelight recently this year, who always used to pick her dogs up after competing. And that drives me mad, because they're obviously hiding shit. And if my dogs are lame, they get time off. They get proper time off. And it just infuriates me when people don't care enough about their animals.
Okay. Next question then. We're going to move on. How to build drive and speed in the ring when you know you can have it in other environments?
I mean, it's a very low. I mean, there's so many answers to that question. I mean, let's just go simple. Half the problem might be coming from the handler, the nerves, the stress they're putting on the dogs. It might be because they haven't built up environmental situations,
yeah.
And they haven't done that. It might be because the dog's stressed in that environment, as in more people around, more dogs around. Are they training it in that environment? Are they taking the toy? Are they going to shows where they can take their reward into the ring? I mean, so many things. But that's okay. So how I would do it is find shows that I can, maybe smaller shows to start with, that I can reward in the ring. So training shows. I would be taking them around the ring a lot to get them used to the environment without actually competing them, just making sure they can play around the rings and eat food around the rings and just enjoy themselves being in that environment. I would then maybe, if they're really stressy, go into a ring, maybe do like three obstacles, run out, get the reward, build up each time, try and do a few more obstacles, and just slowly build everything up. It won't work for all dogs. Some dogs will just never be confident in that environment, which is a shame. But it depends how much work you put in. Some dogs it will work for. So it's very much just trying everything to make it as similar to training as possible.
Some of it might come down to the dog's understanding of what they're asking as well. Like in an environment where they don't have to do set tasks, they probably feel much more free. So if the dog's understanding maybe got better, that might help as well, Dave, do you think?
Definitely.
Okay. Okay, Rachel then asks, living, managing and competing in multi-dog households, how do you manage the needs of all your different ages? She often thinks of Dave when she's cleaning her floors, thinking what is his bloody secret to those clean kitchen floors, because she's got 5 dogs and you've got 1 million and hers is never clean. Well, she needs to get a cleaner, Dave, doesn't she?
Well, one secret is having a Sharon who comes in and cleans only once a week, though. If I compared to coming every day, if I was rich enough for that, I bloody would, because she's brilliant. So having a Sharon in your life to come and clean. Also, I've got a robot Hoover. The best buy I ever bought. It's brilliant. You press the button, off it goes, hoovers everything up, mops the floor. I mean, it doesn't make it as perfect as when Sharon does it, but it does a bloody good job. So having, if you can save up for a robot Hoover, honestly, life changer. And it even would recognize if there was a dog poo on the floor and it wouldn't go over it. Not that it ever has had to. We've not had an accident in the kitchen yet. So it's never, it does it. It's brilliant. But Man, it is hard. I mean, Dan stresses out way more than I do about having multi. He's like, I hate having this many dogs. Obviously, he's got his own. I've got eight. He's got four. It's not completely my fault. Two of them were meant to be shared, but they've just become mine. he struggles more because he wants to give each one of them so much attention. And I do as well, but I'm good at time management. I'm very good at my time management. I think they all do get, it's like if I've competed and worked and done lots of stuff with the young dogs, the older dogs will always come to bed. So I make sure, you know, they get hugs on the bed and they get time for that. You know, I do lots, two separate walks. I just get up early and make sure I do a walk with the young dogs. Then maybe if the old dogs can't go for so long, I'll do a walk with the old dogs. It's just time management is super important. Having a clean house is super important. And that's having a Sharon and a robot Hoover, because that changed my life.
Yeah, I think we could do a whole podcast on like dog gadgets that help with the dog household, can we?
Definitely. But yeah, Dan does stress about more than I do. I just get on with it and just, you know, it's like they've got Fame up with me in here and Forty's up with me in here while I'm doing all this. I just mix them around a lot. Some dogs get a bit of that, some dogs get a bit of that. I'm quite good at my management of it all, but then I'm very used to having a lot of dogs.
I saw something you did the other day. Something you did the other day that I thought was quite cool. For the retired dogs, you did like a little heel work to music competition, didn't you? That was quite good.
Yeah, I was gonna make a little reel of that actually. So that was one of Dan's ideas. He loves doing things like that. So Martin and I came around for our Christmas day yesterday. And so the old dogs came up first. We did some little games with them, some little races, some heel work to music stuff. So they all came out, got them an amazing time. And then we worked with the young dogs after. So they got to do the agility. The old dogs got to have some fun. So we're very much, our old dogs get a ton of attention. You know, I can't stand the thought of my oldies, you know, stopping doing agility and then they just get nothing, because, you know, they were so important. They loved it so much. So we do make sure we make time. A lot of time for old dogs, and Dan is really good at doing that because he's a real old dog fan. Making sure they get a lot of time and attention.
Who won the heel work to music?
Well, Dan would like to say it was Geek, but I think it was Urban. Urban was brilliant. I'm going to put a little reel up of it. Urban was so good. He just didn't, I said a wrong command and he didn't turn the right way, so they marked him down. Oh. And you know what else they marked him down for? Falling over. How can they mark him down for falling over? He slipped on the sand, poor thing. Urban never wins anything. In my mind, Urban won it. And I won't have it any other way. But I tell you who was the worst was Nara Sassy. Couldn't do a bloody thing except jump up and down and butt. So, yeah.
Quite Urban was the winner. Routine then, yeah. Let's move on to the next one. Lynette asks, what in particular made you choose 40 from her litter?
Oh, God. So, well, I wanted a short coat. So there's only two to pick from. And I looked at the others and I loved them, but I thought, no, I'm ruling them out because the whole litter was cool. So I ruled out all the hairy ones. I really wanted, and there was a black and white short coat and a red and white short coat. The black and white was so into me, like loved me, wanted to be with me all the time, would always play. She was so cool. Oh, my God. I kept picking her, then not picking her. 40 was much more independent. Like, I was sitting in the kitchen with Mandy's. Trying to play with her on her own, she'd just be screaming at the bars wanting to get back to the other dogs. So that would really irritate me and put me off for a lot. But when we went up to the arena, 40 ran faster. So I went for the one that ran quicker. And 40 had a really nice structure. And I even got to the point where I measured their chests. I was going for structure a lot this time. And 40 had a slightly smaller chest than Marvel at the time. But, you know, it was tiny little details like that I was going off, because Marvel definitely had the better, more intense focus, but 40 had a really amazing structure. And I thought, I've got one. Susan really likes me and she's into me and sweetie, sweet and lovely. Maybe I should go for the slightly tougher one this time. And I think for me, I definitely picked the right dog because her structure is beautiful. I do think she's got one of the best structures in the litter and I very much went for that. They've all got a good structure. The whole litter are cool. And I think I would have been very happy with Marvel, but I definitely went off structure because it's so important to have good structure these days in agility. And I went off more independent this time. I didn't go for the one that was needy and wanted me. I went for the independent one that was a bit of a bitch, actually. And for me, this time, I think it's definitely made a difference. Her agility is cool and she's very independent and she does lots of cool things. And I'm not saying Marvel doesn't, because Lucy's doing a great job with her too. But I think for me, She's definitely easier to live with than Marble because she is independent. She just goes off and does her own thing, whereas Marble's very needy and shouty and screamy. And I think Lucy struggled with that side of her a bit. And I thought, oh, thank God I got the quiet one.
For a change, yeah. So Jason asks, would really like to know about your warm-up. He said about prep, but I'm not going to go too deep into it because, again, I think with regards to prep, we could go a whole episode on it. But, like, what...
Yeah.
Let's talk about your warm-up specifically. Let's cover kind of some of the main points that you want to achieve in your warm-up. Not for the dog. I'm thinking he's saying for the dog. So, I mean, you do that.
Yeah. So, obviously, so let's say they're completely cold, in the van, straight off. The important things I want to do is obviously increase heart rate, increase breathing, because increasing heart rate, pump the blood around more, is going to warm them up. It's going to create more oxygen going around the body to all the cells and everything. Oxygen creates energy. That obviously makes them pant as well, which brings more air into them, which is obviously increasing oxygen as well. So I want to get heart rate up and I want to warm up their muscles because if they're cold. So I'll do a lot of, to start with, just walking around, building up to maybe a bit of jogging, building up to some tricks. So slowly build up. Don't come straight out and just chuck a ball and do sprints. I want to slowly build it up. I also do a rub down. So I will, there's been studies done on this that when you rub certain, they've done like thermographs, whatever they're called, of before being rubbed down and after. And obviously it's increased the temperature in the body. So if you increase the temperature, that will make your muscles much more flexible. Because cold muscles like cold blue tack snaps, warm muscles like warm blue tack, nice and stretchy and gooey. So you want to warm everything up, increase temperature, increase heart rate, increase breathing rate. They're the three things you really want to be doing to make your dogs have energy, be warm, muscles be more flexible, etc. I think that's probably enough. They're the things I want to do. So I rub down, warm up, exercise, do some tricks. I want to fire up the important muscles, like their jumping muscles, like their glutes, their quads, their hamstrings. So I do sits to stands, down to stands, walking backwards, running forwards, twiddle through my legs. All these different things just to, it takes like anything from, depends how warm the day is as well, from 5 to 15 minutes. If it's their initial warm up, probably take like 15 minutes. If it's their second or third warm up of the day, if they've already done some runs quite close, then it'll probably take a bit less. So it's very much dependent on when I do it as well.
Yep. Quick acronym, I think it's called an acronym that you can remember to help you with your warm up is RAMP. And the R is for raise, as Dave said, raising heart rate, breathing rate, and temperature. A is for activating the muscle groups. M, mobilize, and P, potentiate. So those are the four things that you're looking to do in a warm-up. And one thing that I would say that
what
I think is...
What does potentiate mean?
Say that again.
What do you mean? What does potentiate mean?
So it's those, like... You want to get the muscles ready for the sport, so you want to get them firing quick. Say for example, we're doing the jump, like in dog agility, is jumping, isn't it? And that you want to kind of get those muscle groups firing quickly that they like they would have to in a jump. So whether it's short, sharp sprints, right, cool. Or whether it's like jumping over your arm or something like that, that kind of thing, that would be.
That kind of thing would
be quite useful. But the other thing that is useful for a warm-up, as well as getting ready for performance, is if you can make it so that you do the same one every single time, that warm-up routine brings consistency and it lets the dog know what they're going to be preparing for.
Yeah.
And if you can get that consistency, you'll get more confidence in them as well, I would say.
Definitely.
What would you look for when looking for a new sports... let me read that again. What would you look for when looking for a new sports dog in a breed you don't usually have or aren't used to? It's quite a hard question to answer that, isn't it?
I think I would look for the same things I'd look for in a collie. Like, I don't know, Shelties maybe definitely confidence because they can be unconfident dogs. Malinois maybe less confidence. They can be like savage wolves.
Yeah, I think it's a case of like looking at the breed that you're looking to get and then trying to identify what is a potential weakness.
Yeah,
in the
see
breed.
What their negatives are.
Yeah, yeah.
See what their negative points are that you don't like. Maybe a quiet one if it's a Sheltie.
Yeah.
Spaniels, structure for spaniels is super important. You don't want them big, heavy lumps. You want them quick, you know, not ridiculously fine because that's not what they're made to be, but finer because that's going to make them more whippety looking and run faster probably. And more flexible. Yeah, I think look at the what you would call the negatives of that breed, and try and look for the one that doesn't have those points, and then look for obviously the positives, the opposite of that, and see the ones that does have those points. But yeah, that's a hard question to ask.
It is, because it's very like there's so many. You could look at it from so many different points of views, from so many different breeds. Yeah. So yeah, I think look at what are the potential weaknesses for that breed, and then try and pick a puppy who doesn't show those. So Grimstone Dog Walking says, how would you support positive mental health in agility?
Okay, that's so with people. So I think it's hard because it is, agility is stressful and it is upsetting. It's very emotional when you want, you're so desperate to do well and one thing can go wrong. But I think it's important to very much take the positives from every run. There's always a positive, like it's somewhere there'll be a positive. If there isn't, then well, this is a really bad one. You guys just got to forget it. Why before I start again? But there's usually at least one positive, even if it's a good weight, even if they kept jump one up. You know, think of the positives.
Enthusiasm. So, even if they took every pole, at least they were enthusiastic about it.
Yeah, at least they ran fast. That's what I used to be like with fame. At least she's going quick and look pretty over the jumps. So, yeah, I think make sure you're definitely looking at positives, not negatives. I think what else you might have some ideas on this because you're probably more into that than I am.
I think the one about, like I say, focusing on the things that go well is important. I think when we are looking at courses, we can often, I mean, I'm talking about myself, but I'm sure other people are the same. We focus on the bad, don't we? We focus on the bits that went bad, on the bits that we can be doing better. And it's just so easy to forget that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to get into any competition ring, you'll have had to have done a lot of good things first. And then I think another important thing is to surround yourself with people who are also positive, supportive and positive. You know, if you're in a group of people who are always focusing on the negative things, that's not going to be good for you.
And I think that's very much like my group of friends are super supportive to each other and we all want each other to do well. And I think making a plan, if something's gone wrong, don't just dwell on it. Make a plan of how to make it better. How you're going to fix that thing that went wrong. Don't just go, oh, it's gone wrong. It's the end of the world. You know, that's how I'm very good. I'm always about 10 minutes and really shitty about it. And then I make a plan of how that's not going to happen again in the future.
Yeah. I think it's a case of seeing the things that go wrong as a chance to learn, isn't it? That's what growth mindset is.
Yeah.
And if you don't take it it's almost like don't take it personally. If something goes wrong, it goes wrong, but that's not something to be upset about. That's just an opportunity to improve in an area. So I think the way that you frame the negatives is an important one as well. But yeah, focus on some of the good stuff, frame the bad stuff as chances to learn, and hang around with people who are supportive and people who are generally positive. That's three good bits of advice there, I would say.
Yeah.
So last question then. When you've seen other dogs or experienced your own dogs being injured through agility, purely accidental or not, I would hope it's not accidental. I hope you don't go around beating your dogs, Dave. How do you deal with the crisis of confidence that can occur, and how in your own moral code do you justify or reconcile your decision to continue to choose this sport for your dogs? And Sprite says it's just something that's been on their mind recently.
So yeah, a few people have asked me this in the past, and it's not something I've ever considered, because injuries are going to happen in any sport. And more dogs get injured, more pet dogs get injured than agility dogs all the time. Like any injury can happen at any point. I was sitting on the sofa the other day and I hurt my neck doing absolutely fuck all. And so, yes, obviously agility is going to increase the risk in some ways, but they love it. If they don't love it, I personally wouldn't do it with a dog that didn't love it. Like Urban did not like shows, and I think he's got something wrong with his eyesight, so I stopped doing shows with him and just trained him. Like I wouldn't do it with a dog that doesn't love it. And if they love it, then I would think, same as me, I would rather do something I love and potentially get an injury than sit around all day and not do something I love. So that's how I see it. Sit on the sofa and do nothing. So, and I think that the dogs, I honestly believe if I could talk to them and give them a choice, that the ones I've chosen to continue it with would choose to continue it even though there was a risk. So I truly, truly believe that they would do it because they love it that much. Would they love another sport so much? Maybe, but would I love it so much? Probably not. So it is, you know, at the end of the day, I have so many dogs because I love doing agility. But anything you do with your dogs, even just walking your dogs is a risk, like the way they run around and be lunatics. So yeah. I'd rather control that risk of doing something they love than just doing random nothing with them and still get an injury anyway.
I would say that it's like, I know more people who've had horrific injuries through walking their dogs, and I'm not saying there hasn't been these in agility, but it can come from walking your dogs as well. The question that I'd ask you, Sprite, is, are you finding that your dogs are picking up injuries quite commonly? And I'm not asking this specifically to you, but the question I would ask someone is, are your dogs continuously picking up injuries in agility? And then if they are, I think you need to have a look at why. You know, maybe it is the courses you're running. Maybe it's the physical preparation that they're doing. Maybe it could be anything, right? And like, it's impossible for me and Dave to kind of find out what that is here.
No.
But if, for example, your dogs are continuously picking up an injury, there might be a reason for that. And that might be something that you can help them with. So potentially that's something to look at.
Looking at courses, warm-ups, are they fit enough? Do they understand the skills? Do they know how to hit an A-frame with the speed? Do they know how to go into a tunnel at speed? You know, if they don't have the skills for it, like, I think we train our dogs, like me and Dan and Kurt, enough that they're prepared to do the course. That's why I don't run a lot of courses at shows, because I personally feel I haven't prepared my dogs for that style of course, because I think that style of course is dangerous if I want to teach them to run the speed they run at. So it's not because I just hate the courses and I'm being a twat about it. It's because I truly am worried about my dogs' physical well-being if I put them in that course and they run at full speed like I've taught them to, because it's not safe to run at that speed. And people go, oh, you should be able to do any course. Well, if you teach your dogs to be world champ style speed, which I obviously will try and do with all my dogs because that's my aim, then they can't do some of these courses that they see in the UK, because they are just dangerous for that speed. Other dogs that are slower, they might not be dangerous for, but if they're going fast, then they're going to be dangerous. And my dogs are prepped for doing things at speed. If you've got a fast dog with an inexperienced handler that hasn't prepped them properly, then it's even more bloody dangerous, because the dogs definitely won't be prepped to see that, what they're seeing in the ring. So that is a huge thing, is course design, is why we go on about it as much as we do.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I think that's all for the questions this week. We've got a couple more, but I think we're going to be taking it a little bit too far if we do any more. So we're going to stop there. Before we go, though, Dave, I know you've got some exciting stuff happening on QME, on your website and on your Facebook group. So do you want to tell the people about that before we go?
Yes, so soon, hopefully, we will be changing to a subscription site. I think I might have mentioned it in the last one, but changing to a subscription site. I'm doing loads more stuff on my social media now, lots of little snippets of training and fun memes and stuff like that. So join up to my Instagram, QME Agility, and my Facebook page, QME Agility, and I can get loads of people on there rather than just stuck with the 5,000 friends on Facebook on my personal account. And definitely look out for the release of the site, because it's going to be so much information. You're going to get the crew for free. You're going to be able to ask for feedback. Oh, there's so many more options, and you're going to get so much more information on the monthly subscription. And there's no sign up time. You can sign up and leave at any point. I think I'm really excited about the developments of how the site's going. I want to build a nice QME community.
Yeah. And the one thing that I think is really good from a point of view of someone who's used it myself is, within the subscription service, not only is it like you get part of the QME crew, you get access to all of the modules you've got as well, didn't you? And you can have them for as long as you want, as long as you want to stay a member.
Yeah, and you can just look at them, you can go through them your own time. I'm going to build in all sorts of things, like people are going to get little rewards for finishing modules. And I've got so many cool plans coming up, which Kurt's helped me with quite a lot, so well done, Kurt. Yeah. So we've got so many cool plans coming up for the development and how I'm going to progress it. Because I've been doing the module sales for ages now, and it's been great, but I think it's time to change it up a little bit and give people even more for their money.
Yep, it should be really cool. So I'm looking forward to that too. But yeah, that's us done for this week, Dave. Do you want to say goodbye?
Cool. Bye, everyone. Yeah, see you soon.
See you in the next one. And that is the end of the podcast. Thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen. I really hope you enjoyed. If you think you might know someone else who would enjoy, feel free to pass on all the information and share the podcast with them, and get involved on any of the social media platforms. It really helps the podcast grow, and I really appreciate it. See you in the next one.